Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, deficit debate, a tough G20 meeting, and a blast from the presidential past. President Obama didn't exactly get what he wanted at the G20 meeting in South Korea, but he pushed for global economic rebalancing.
Exchange rates must reflect economic realities. Just as the major advanced economies need to keep working to preserve stability among reserve currencies, emerging economies need to allow for currencies that are market-driven.
The Bipartisan Deficit Commission tipped its hand. Hot debate and big warnings already. Here's co-chair Erskine Bowles.
This debt is like a cancer that will truly destroy this country from within if we don't fix it.
And George W. Bush reemerged with his new memoir. He told NBC's Matt Lauer the jury is still out on whether his presidency succeeded.
I'm going to be dead, Matt, when they finally figure it out. And I'm comfortable knowing that I gave it my all, that I love America, and that and I know it's an honor to serve.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Todd Purdom, national editor for Vanity Fair, Chrystia Freeland, global editor-at-large for Thomson Reuters, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Todd, Chrystia, Jack, it's great to have you all here. Chrystia, let me come first to you, if I may. G20 just wrapping up. President's off to Japan already. But he did not get what he wanted in Seoul. What just happened there, Chrystia?
Well, I think this was a really crucial meeting. I think this was the first meeting where America wasn't in charge. And it was the first meeting where, really since the Cold War, where the world is now saying to America, actually, we don't think that you guys know the best way to run a modern economy. And that's kind of shocking for Americans to hear. But that was the very clear message from the Germans, from the British, from the Chinese. And, you know, this is part of, I think, the sort of prolonged reaction to the financial crisis and also to this sort of massive rebalancing of the global economy. I think this meeting showed that that's going to be a really, really tough process. And America has to sort of figure out how to communicate with the rest of the world.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It sounded like, you know, global rankings shifting there, global gears, global power really shifting all of a sudden. Here was the president talking tough as he left that G20 meeting. Let's listen.
It is undervalued. And China spends enormous amounts of money intervening in the market to keep it undervalued.
Now, I should have said there, he's talking about China's currency. Of course, that's become a big issue, Chrystia. And there's the president, you know, saying it directly in China's face. He sat down with the Chinese leader at this meeting, but he came with specific goals about the kind of statement he wanted from G20 on this, and he didn't get it.
That's right. And as it happens, I think the president is right when he talks about the Chinese currency being undervalued and being artificially undervalued and that being part of a very clear and intentional Chinese policy to have an export-driven economy and export-driven growth. The problem and what undercuts the president's message at a forum like this one is the rest of the world feels that right now America is also a bad actor in the global economy. And that came out particularly strongly following last week's injection of, you know, or planned injection of $600 billion into the economy by the U.S. Federal Reserve. To the rest of the world, that also looks like currency manipulation, and that looks like maybe a cheap way to pay off the debt that the U.S. owes to a lot of foreign players, you know, just by printing more money. So that's why that message, I think, didn't resonate with the strength that maybe Washington had hoped.
Todd Purdom, the Washington went into this meeting wanting the G20 to nail China down with specific targets on, you know, changing this trade balance, changing that currency regime. The president came out without that. Do you see? I mean, there is a promise here to work on it in the future, but, you know, China came in, hip-checked the United States on a more explicit promise here. Do you see the kind of, I don't know, the world rankings on the power chart changing right here, right now, Todd?
Well, it's a fair point. I mean, there's a promise, too, to keep working on the trade deal with South Korea. Mm-hmm. But this was an opportunity to get a firm deal on that, and it didn't happen. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the other actors look at our domestic situation here at home. They see President Obama's weakened condition after the midterms. They frankly see on total parade complete dysfunction. You know, when the Deficit Commission comes out with the chairman's sort of initial talking points, which I'm sure the chairman effectively put out only to get a discussion going because they're a little bit deadlocked on the commission. You see someone like Speaker Pelosi out of the box say it's, quote, simply unacceptable. I mean, she doesn't even say, well, we'll have to look at it carefully. She doesn't even buy time. So I think it's fair for other actors on the world stage to think that here in America we're not really serious about addressing some of our own most severe problems.
Here's a little bit of British Prime Minister. We'll come to that deficit panel in a big way and just in a couple of minutes here. But here's the, again at the G20 summit, British Prime Minister David Cameron saying, you know, there's been important work done. But listen to him talk about the dangers that are out there in the world right now. Of course, he's got British jobs, British business at the front of his mind, but he's also got concerns.
We will be hit very hard by trade wars, by currency wars, by tit-for-tat measures, the things that happened in the 1930s, the things that there are pressures today in the world to bring about. We would suffer from those. And so working through the G20 to say, no, we're not going to have protectionism. Yes, we're going to try and get the Doha round going again. Yes, we're going to support free trade. That is good for British jobs, good for British business.
Good for British business. Jack Beattie, I mean, here was the president to move to these South Korean trade talks. The South Korea exports something like 700,000 cars to the United States. U.S. manufacturers send something like 6,000 to South Korea, and he couldn't get a trade deal that might help begin to change that. How do you think this image of what's going on with U.S. standing, U.S. clout in the G20 is going to ripple back into American politics, Jack?
Well, in the first place, it is surprising that he would fare with South Korea of all nations on Earth. You'd think that there we would have some leverage. I mean, we, after all, our troops are there. We defend South Korea. Is there any grace to be got out of that? Apparently not. I'm not clear exactly on why the deal foundered. Ford Motor Company put out an ad using the statistics you mentioned, mm-hmm. 56 Korean cars sold here to one American car there. And it sounded as if part of the problem was that their environmental standards are a kind of non-tariff trade barrier. They're very high for cars, and safety standards likewise. And Detroit says that's a non-tariff barrier. Well, perhaps, but does it also mean that we have to improve our safety standards? So I just don't know. But coming back here, it looks very bad for free trade. The polls show that more Americans think it harms than helps the country. Liberals are certainly unhappy about the loss of manufacturing jobs they ascribe to trade. The Tea Party in the caucus of the Republican Party very strongly dubious about the benefits of trade. So the president says he will kick this down the road, and within not months, he says, but weeks, we'll have a deal with South Korea. Maybe, but people are beginning to doubt it.
Christy, you've been writing really interestingly just in the last few days. Let me quote you here for just a minute. You wrote, a favorite theme of American business and political elites at the moment is that authoritarian regimes, i.e. China, may be better at making hard long-term economic decisions than our querulous democracies, i.e. the United States. This week, in fact, the U.S., you wrote, itself offered a case study in this scary theory. I mean, there is a kind of a global conversation, debate going on. It may not be in the main headlines, but just behind them, Christian, you're pointing at it here, about what works best, who wins economically.
Well, just to be clear, I am a big fan of democracy. I think authoritarian regimes are terrible. My grandparents actually fled from the communist Soviet Union. So just to lay my cards out there. Having said that, I do think that right now one of the reasons that the American voice in the global economic discussion is muted and is not as trusted as I would like it to be is a lot of people are saying the Americans are not able to take on the big national projects. They're not able to get their debt under control. They're not able to do the big infrastructure projects. And guess what? Who's able to do this? The authoritarian Chinese. I think it's a little bit false to equate Chinese authoritarianism with the effectiveness of the government, but it's certainly true that American government isn't looking very effective. And I think that that's a real danger, a real political danger right now.
It's a powder keg here at home. We'll talk about that. But Todd Purdom, I mean, here's maybe international ramifications. Diddle around at home and sooner or later people notice.
Well, look at the contrast with what Prime Minister Cameron is proposing in Britain, the deadly serious kind of cuts and recalibrations of the British social welfare system that he's willing to put on the table. Contrast that with the fundamental unseriousness of the discussion we're having here in Washington, the basic unseriousness of the Republicans' pledge to America, which did not really spell out in any material way real painful cuts that would be needed to do what they say they want to do, which is to bring spending in line. So I think, you know, Chris's makes a good point. I mean, we're all for democracy, and not every democracy is dysfunctional, but it seems that ours has reached a modern apex of dysfunction.
And Jack, the notion that you can just fool around with these things forever and the rest of the world will sit idly by waiting for you to get your house in order and respecting the status you've had seemed to me to be really getting its own shellacking, that notion this week.
Oh, indeed. And, you know, when you have Chancellor Merkel saying, well, instead of having numerical benchmark targets for how much countries should export, why don't countries that don't make competitive products become competitive? Well, that was aimed directly at the United States. Why talk about devaluing your currency? Just make better products and people will want to buy them. Ooh, what unkind cut that was.
Pull up your socks, USA. Get your house in order. But what does that mean? We'll talk about it after a break. This is On Point. We'll be right back. President Obama put together this commission hoping to get something on the table that the country could get to work in on that big deficit. They came out on Wednesday, the two chairmen, bipartisan deficit commission, Democrat Erskine Bowles and Republican Alan Simpson, to give a hint of where they're headed. They released a draft of some of their recommendations on federal debt reduction. Here's Erskine Bowles, formerly in the Clinton administration.
Senator Simpson and I put what I think is a strong, balanced proposal out there to deal with what I think is the most predictable economic crisis this country has ever faced. Every single member of Congress knows that the path we're on today is not sustainable, and that if we don't bring these deficits down and eventually get to balance, you know, we are headed for disaster.
Wyoming's Alan Simpson, in his colorful way, said they had looked for cuts everywhere.
It's all there. We have harpooned every whale in the ocean and some of the minnows.
Every whale and some of the minnows. President Obama, looking on from a news conference at the G20 in South Korea, said, all right, let's all sort of stay calm and be straight here.
Before anybody starts shooting down proposals, I think we need to listen. We need to gather up all the facts. I think we have to be straight with the American people.
But Tea Party folks came out right away, very angry about the idea of tax hikes. And here's AFL-CIO president, labor leader Richard Trumka, denouncing what he'd seen from the other side of the political range.
Well, the chairman of the Deficit Commission just told working people to drop dead, that they're the losers, and Wall Street and the rich are the winners.
Todd Purdom in Washington, what do you see in this first kind of broad brush peek we get at what's maybe coming out from this deficit commission?
Well, Tom, let's remember why this commission exists in the first place. Mm-hmm. Commissions are the last refuge of scoundrels because Congress can't agree on anything that's controversial and important. And Congress, in fact, couldn't even agree on appointing a commission that would have binding authority.
Right.
So it fell to President Obama to impanel this one that would have mere advisory power. And then they come out, the chairman, with their first blush, you know, serious discussion, which is entitled to serious respect, I think, and they get this kind of reaction. I actually saw Senator Simpson this summer in Wyoming in his hometown of Cody, and, I mean, he was expecting, you know, to get a very negative reaction if they were at all honest about their ideas. But it is pretty depressing to think that even a body which was created solely to insulate politicians from pressure cannot get a civil hearing from politicians who are rushing to their assigned roles, you know, immediately.
Well, maybe that's what's going on. I mean, people take this seriously. It is serious business. They have a December 1st deadline to do what exactly, Todd?
Well, if they can reach consensus of 14 of the 18 members, and I think that's still not 100% clear that they'll be able to do that, then they have a mandate to come out with a set of recommendations, which would then be a starting point for legislative discussion and negotiation. Significantly, the Republican leadership, at least, has kept its powder drier. It has not come out with ironclad statements of one kind or another. And, you know, there's plenty in there for Republicans not to like, including, as you pointed out, the notion of tax increases. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when President Obama gets back, when December 1st rolls around, how serious this discussion will ultimately be.
Was it Dick Durbin, Christopher Freeland, saying he looks at some of what's in here like the devil looks at holy water? Do you see a persuasive outline of a deficit-cutting plan? And, of course, when you work on this scale, Christia, you know, people are favored and people are disfavored. What does this look like to you?
Well, I think that the basic concept is a really good one. I like the fact that there are some sacred cows that are slaughtered, or at least their slaughter is contemplated. The mortgage tax deduction, I think, is very good to see there.
To see that go away, a lot of people count on that in their tax returns.
People do, but that is part of the distortion of the American economy. You know, that's part of the reason that you had a housing bubble, is because the tax system nudges people towards borrowing more money in order to buy a house. And I think Americans have seen that that's not really a very great sustainable way to build an economy. What I think needs to happen, and I'm in no way predicting that this will happen, the only way that deficit reduction programs work is if politicians can sell a country on shared sacrifice and build a program which is really about shared sacrifice. And that means Wall Street has to get hit and Main Street has to get hit. And there has to be a view that the whole country is coming together around this. I think that there are some of the ingredients of that in this proposal. But the big question is going to be whether the president can go out and sell that to the country.
Jack Beatty, when you look at all the elements, do you see shared sacrifice in this draft?
I do not. I think this is a kicking away of the scaffolding that has supported, for better or worse, the American middle class in the post-war era. Not just the mortgage interest deduction, but the employer deduction for health care, the deduction for state and local income taxes. And why are these deductions taken away? In order to drop marginal rates to as low as 23%, which, of course, would be a bonanza for the richest American. So it looks to me like there's a kind of transfer up. And on this, on Social Security, which needs just a minor adjustment, the idea of raising the retirement age to 69, you know, I was looking at the data. Manual workers live on average 8 years less than professionals. So essentially, you're going to have some truck driver retiring and you know, having his year on Social Security and then dying. I mean, it's a kind of class bias in that. And then Medicare, they don't really do anything with Medicare. Where is the means testing? Where is adjustment? Some vague language about that. And on the other side, where is a Tobin tax on speculation? Where is a value-added tax on high luxury goods? Where are the kinds of things that could at once bring down the debt and the deficit and restore a measure of fairness to the society?
Todd Purdom, do you see a class tilt in this draft in favor of the wealthy, away from the middle class, or not, something else?
Well, I think Jack makes very fair points. I think that's part of the debate that should happen. And, I mean, I just think so often, you know, I wish Jack were in Congress, because he just, in a minute and a half, made a very persuasive argument from his perspective. And I just don't think we have that kind of honest dialogue often enough. I don't think it's quite so class heavy as he might think it is, but it's a very fair point that somebody's winning and somebody's losing, whatever you do in American financial and tax policy. And, you know, there are a lot of anomalies built into it. The mortgage interest deduction has been kind of the paramount centerpiece of the American dream in many ways. But you could argue that as a proposition, it doesn't make the most sense. So I don't know.
So if we got necessary medicine here, or kicking away the scaffolding of the American middle class, what do you say, Christian?
I just wanted to jump in with one point for Jack, which is, first of all, to say I think his class analysis is absolutely correct. And something that is sometimes missing from the American political discourse is a really clear-eyed sense of who's winning, who's losing. I don't want to sound too Marxist here, but it's that classic Bolshevik question of, you know, kto kogo. Having said that,
a few rich people think about it too, I think.
The one thing I would say to Jack on this is actually getting the deficit under control benefits the middle class, and I would say the lower middle class most of all. And that is because if the deficit isn't brought under control, what's going to happen is the debt will be paid down by stealth through inflation. And we're already seeing that with quantitative easing from the Fed. And that policy is an absolute the rich get richer policy. That's a policy which gives really cheap money to the strongest players in the economy, to the banks, to the big companies. And what it does is if you're on a fixed income, if you don't have a lot of debt, your income is eroded. So, you know, it is important to understand that for the middle class, and especially the lower middle class, sleepwalking into a big debt is actually a really, really big danger. That's part of the reason that so European social democrats have been so worried about this.
Jack, I'll come to you on that. We've got a lot of people calling in on this, and we're going to be hearing a lot more about this in the months ahead. But let's listen to our listeners. Montgomery, Alabama. Ronnie, you're on the air, Ronnie.
Yes, thank you. I originally called on the G20, but also, if I've heard right, like on mortgage interest, it's for mortgages of $500,000 plus. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that right? Okay. So it's okay, but it's still the average mortgage is well below that.
Yes, I say. Well, what middle class person has a house where he's carrying a mortgage of $500,000 plus? You know, for the people to say it's going to affect, you know, the middle class. You know, I'd like to find a half a dozen middle class people that have a house that's carrying a $500,000 mortgage or plus. I says that. You know, that more or less is going to affect the rich in this country, not the middle class. So how can anybody say it's going to affect the middle class?
I hear you there, Ronnie, though in some areas of, I don't know, California, Phoenix, before it crashed, there might be some middle class people in those very high cost housing areas who thought so. But Chris, just to confirm, that means anybody with a mortgage less than $500,000 would still be deducting their mortgage interest payments under this plan and this draft anyway?
That's the draft proposal, yes.
Jack, what do you say? That sounds like some headroom for the middle class.
Well, yeah, that's a fine print I didn't see, and I should have seen. I would make your point, though, Tom. I mean, $500,000, it sounds beyond the dreams of avarice to me, but, you know, a couple living in Manhattan, that, unfortunately, is the size mortgage, I'm sure, many just people who think of themselves as middle class and who in Manhattan are middle class, that's what they pay. And similarly in Los Angeles. So I wouldn't, but in most parts of the country, that does seem excessive indeed. But then look at things like this, the earned income tax credit, that would be eliminated. That's one of the main weapons by which the government fights poverty. That's helped keep people afloat, people who work. It's a supplement to wages earned. It's not welfare. And that's damaging. And back to return to Chris's point about, yes, of course, inflation is terribly punishing for the lower middle class, for all Americans, really, except for people who are well insulated. But the question is, how do you get there? And isn't it ironic that on the day this report is released, the administration should be signaling that it's willing to give ground on a tax cut for the top 2% on the Bush tax? They're willing to say, well, we'll let that go on for another year or two, which adds $700 billion over 20 years to the deficit. So it's just out comes this. I think
the president has jumped back in on that, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, I've got a little tape. I mean, David Axelrod told the Huffington Post that led people to believe that they were going to be, you know, signing off on extended tax cuts for everybody. That's a little unclear right now. Here's the president speaking yesterday at the G20. President Obama kind of clarifying that position.
I want to make sure that taxes don't go up for middle-class families starting on January 1st. That's my number one priority for those families and for our economy. I also believe that it would be fiscally irresponsible for us to permanently extend the high income tax cuts. I think that would be a mistake.
Of course, that's what Republicans want. But, Todd, there is some wiggle room in there, temporarily extending those high income tax cuts.
I was going to say the crucial word there is permanently. And I've thought for weeks that the obvious deal is something about a temporary extension of the tax cuts for the upper income brackets. And you saw a month or so ago, Congressman Boehner actually dipped his toe in the water of compromise by saying that he would not vote against tax relief for people earning under $250,000 if the only way he could do it was to have it decoupled, you know, from tax relief for continued tax cuts for the wealthy. He promptly had to kind of recalibrate that after his own members, you know, criticized him for doing that. But I mean, just as a matter of finding the balance, there's a natural place for compromise, and that's have some temporary extension.
And that may
And that kind of decoupling.
Christian, yeah.
Yes, sorry for jumping in. I think that Todd's point about the decoupling could really be politically smart for the Democrats if they could achieve that, because then you could get to a place where once this temporary period ends, you're voting straight on do you extend tax cuts for the rich or not. And that becomes really much harder to support than supporting an extension of tax cuts for everybody.
Here's John Boehner, House Speaker-to-be, perhaps, saying he's in no mood for any kind of extension of a tax increase. He's on Fox News with Brett Baer.
We don't want to increase taxes on any American.
So there's no compromise here?
We do not want to raise taxes on any American.
I know. The president is saying he wants to reach out. He wants to meet with you. He thinks there could be a deal here. You're saying no.
Listen, Democrats still control the Congress for the next 2 months. And I suspect we're going to have a whale of a fight over taxes and spending.
No doubt. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska. And Chuck, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, two quick comments on compromise that I think make a ton of sense. On the mortgage deduction, what they should do is they should leave the mortgage deduction in place for a primary residence, and for a vacation property or a second property, not investor property, you shouldn't be able to deduct the interest. It's craziness.
Which you can do right now, but of course you're going to raise a lot more money if they take it away across the board, Chuck.
Well, but here's the deal. Nobody can argue. If I said that the only people that are going to pay additional or give away that mortgage credit are people that are blessed enough to have a second home, how can most Americans argue against that? It would save money. It doesn't make any sense. The second thing, real quickly, Tom, mm-hmm. is on the tax cuts. The Republican issue has been that it will eliminate jobs. There's an easy answer. You extend the tax cuts for the 250 income or above for people who are not W-2 earners. So if you're a W-2 earner and you make 250 or above, so you're a hedge fund manager, you're a banker, you're whatever, you are no longer eligible for the tax cut.
Do you make 250 plus, Chuck? Would you be willing to pay more? Are you ready?
Well, absolutely. And you know what? I'm in both of those categories. I have a home, a vacation home, and I make that, and I'm a W-2 earner. But again, who can argue against that? Because then you let all small businesses who file under S chapter, whatever.
Well, the Tea Party's arguing against it right now. I'm sorry, Chuck, but a break's coming here. Tea Party's arguing against that. John Boehner, we just heard, arguing against that. We'll come back and look more at who's going to give what to get at that deficit in this country and much more. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a Carnival cruise ship lost power off the coast of Mexico, had to be towed to San Diego. Passengers had to eat Spam. Here's one singing Gilligan style as she left the ship.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. San Diego, not the sea. San Diego, not the sea.
Oh, boy. Bernie Madoff's possessions will be auctioned off this weekend, right down to his boxers. Everything. Here's a sampling.
What you will see is some very eccentric collections of shoes. Lots of monogrammed BLM, RM for Ruth. They like to mark what they owned.
And Carrot Top Conan O'Brien is back on Late Night with TBS.
People ask me why I named the show Conan. I did it so I'd be harder to replace. He's out. Get another Conan.
Oh, boy. All late night. Todd, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats, and then we'll look at Republicans as well in the House. But Nancy Pelosi, many thought she'd be out of the leadership as Newt Gingrich left the leadership after the Republican setback in the 90s. But no, she's fighting on. Why? What's going on?
Well, I think for one thing, she doesn't want to walk away feeling beaten. It's just not in her spirit. She comes from a fighting Baltimore political family, as you know, and I think she's got her dander up and she's not going to walk off. The second reason is if she does want to stay on as speaker, there's no one who can beat her. So, to stay on as minority leader. So the logic in doing it is that she's the one. Her caucus is more liberal now. A lot of the Blue Dogs lost last week. So in some ways, her support is stronger than ever among her members.
She's saying she wants to stay in there and to work with Republicans to solve problems. Here she is talking with NPR's Renee Montagne, just aired this morning.
I'm running to put together the strongest plan to work with the Republicans to solve problems. The biggest problem is unemployment. I hope we can work together to create jobs. And I do so with the overwhelming support of my caucus, not the unanimous support.
Jack Beatty, right person to lead the Democrats now after the shellacking?
Well, you know, I think it has to be said that even if you don't agree with the policy, she's been one of the most effective speakers in modern times. The big things have got done. Hard votes have been taken on her watch, under her leadership. And I've talked to congresspeople who say, listen, if you see how she works her coalitions, something for the Blue Dogs, something for the Liberals, how she keeps people together, she's really been a tremendously effective inside player. Having said that, the Republicans spent, I don't know, millions of dollars in ads demonizing her in the last campaign. Her negatives are extremely high. They may be as high as anybody's in public life. I don't think it's fair, but that's the fact. And is it really wise for the party that she should be its face for the next 2 years or more? I mean, Steny Hoyer, her possible replacement, the current majority leader, he's unknown to the public. He's unknown to the Republic. They probably would demonize him, but it would be slightly harder since he's more conservative. So I understand why she's saying she wants to stay on, but I'm not sure it's in the best interest of her party.
Todd and Christian, I want to come to both of you on this. I mean, what do you anticipate here? We had the call from Jim DeMint for a kind of absolutist purity on the right. Now the Democrats have taken that thumping in the House, lost the majority there. As you say, Todd, it's going to be more liberals coming in. A lot of the moderates are gone. So do you see the House Democrats circling the wagons ideologically here? And if they do that, what's the interaction going to be with the White House? What's the compass setting at the White House looking like at this point?
Well, if they do that, there's going to be a lot of tension with the White House, because I think the White House, and to a lesser degree the congressional Republicans, feel that in the next couple of years they really maybe have to get some things done. I think if John Boehner does become the speaker, he's acutely aware that majorities in this era are fragile and transient, and I think he thinks that eventually he and his colleagues have to give members and the public something to be for instead of just be against. Now, it looks like Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, is shaping up as kind of the bad cop in the whole play here, and that maybe there'll be room for John Boehner and Barack Obama to take a little more conciliatory tone. Although you have to say that as personalities, the president and Congressman Boehner don't seem to have that much in common, unlike, say, Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, who were both brainy Southerners who understood each other, thought they had the measure of the other.
Now, on the Republican side of the aisle, the majority to be, Todd, we saw the Representative Michelle Bachmann, who's kind of the leader of the U.S., the Tea Party caucus, is the leader of the Tea Party caucus in the House. She dropped her bid just in the last 24 hours or two.
Yeah, it was clear she was not going to go anywhere. Those leadership races are not won on cable television or with the most extreme members of the party. They're won in the cloakroom and among the membership, and I don't think she ever had any serious hope of winning.
Christian Phelan, with all that, do you see gridlock coming here or the White House reaching out to the Republican majority in the House, getting something done? What?
I sadly feel that gridlock is looking more likely right now. And I think a really important element to add to our analysis of this is what's happening with the economy. I think that really was the decisive factor in the midterms, and I think it is going to be what shapes politics over the next 2 years. And I think the Republicans are going to be looking at that very, very closely. And if they see an economy which continues to be weak, I think there is going to be a lot of support for the Mitch McConnell just say no political line. And I think you're going to have Republicans arguing, you know, that they want to keep the economy to be owned by the Democrats and by the White House so that in 2012, that's what the Republicans can run against.
Gina in Evansville, Indiana. Hi, Gina. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to mention that not once have we heard the government say where they're going to cut back. We continue to put this on the backs of the American public. I've not heard any government agency talk about we're not going to have the golden parachute anymore, their retirement, we're not going to have their Social Security. They don't ever talk about what they're going to give up.
Now, who do you mean exactly, Gina? Do you mean, government bureaucrats, congressmen?
Congressmen, the senators, mm-hmm. the House, none of them. What do we pay per? How many congressmen do we have sitting on the sidelines who are still collecting a check? When we lose our job, we don't continue to get a job, get a check, a paycheck, but they continue to.
Yeah, looking at those politicians themselves. I hear it, Gina. Gina, let us pick that up. I mean, Jack, there's been this conversation emerging, you know, that in some ways what people are looking at who are having trouble in this economy, what people see, Gina sees, is not necessarily right or left, but a kind of elite that's insulated and a population that's not.
Yeah, oh, yes, so well said. And, a congressional retirement package is a scandal. I mean, it. And what she says is true. They virtually collect their whole salary in retirement. I forget what the figures are, but they're shocking. And, at $163,000 a year, they're all in what? That has to be the top 5% anyway.
Must be, yeah.
There was a serious academic paper a couple of years ago in the American Political Science Review saying to narrow this gap between people and elite leaders, why not make the leaders, for example, stay in public housing, earn the minimum wage, earn a living wage? In other words, set parameters that would put them directly in touch with what's going on in the country. And as I say, this was in the American Political Science Review, and the reviewer was saying this is consonant with what the founding fathers would have wanted, with what Republican large R theorists have wanted over the years.
I don't know, Jack. I mean, Mount Vernon, Monticello, they didn't look like public housing to me, but then,
I'm just
a regular guy.
But no. But the idea that the leaders can't be in another remove entirely from the lid, and that the self-dealing of elites, once they're insulated, is, it just invites abuse and corruption.
And on whose behalf?
Is there a danger, Jack, that if that happens, you only have rich people running for public office?
We've got that already in the Senate. Aren't they all gazillionaires there now?
That's true. They are. I guess that would be one of the downsides.
One small word of defense for Congressman, though. I mean, if you're making $160,000 a year and you're trying to commute to your district and you're trying to keep some version of two residences, even if you only have a bachelor apartment in Washington, and you have all kinds of limitations on what you can earn in outside income and all kinds of restrictions on honoraria you can take, I mean, it's not a picnic. I mean, they're not getting rich. They might be rich by virtue of other things they did before they got to Congress, but I don't think very many members of the House particularly are getting rich because they're in Congress.
But to Gina's point, don't forget about people who don't have any kind of backstop like that, and there are many, many millions of them. Bob in Newmarket, Virginia. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to bring up, we talk about hard right, hard left, and all that's fine and dandy. No one's going to agree on everything, but let's ditch the extreme ideas on both sides. And let's just focus on what people can agree on and then pass laws on just what they can agree on, and the rest of it we'll tackle later. The stuff that needs to happen, it needs to happen now. And, these people are sticking way too much to their ideology, values, and, I just don't understand why we can't get something done right now.
Bob, I hear you loud and clear. And Todd, I mean, I've seen polls saying, Bob is by no means alone in this view. It's like, come on, the rest of the world is moving. And here we are mud wrestling, year after year after year. Let's get it together. Do you see the elements emerging here, Todd, to have that happen from something that people can agree is a reasonable center?
Well, he makes a completely reasonable point, and the thing that I don't understand, really, is the level of cognitive dissonance that's operating here. Because all the politicians today say just what Bob said, that the American people want us to get together, find solutions.
No, they do not all say that.
I mean, I think many of them do say that, though. They say it, but they don't mean it, and then they don't act on it. Mm. But, I mean, they all pay lip service to it. Now, I'm not saying
they
Jim
don't
DeMint
all pay lip
that.
Service. Jim DeMint doesn't pay lip service to that. The Tea Party doesn't.
But I would say there's the critical mass of politicians, let me say, the largest preponderance, a plurality of most national political figures do say that. They just don't act on it. And, you know, Jim DeMint gets more ink and airtime than his position deserves as representing. You know, Jim DeMint does not in any sense represent the consensus of the Senate, much less the consensus of the Republican caucus in the Senate. He's an outlier. Michelle Bachmann's an outlier. The loudest
Todd,
voice is getting a lot of attention.
I shouldn't single out Jim DeMint. I mean, there are others on the left who will have their positions. The question seems to be these days, you know, what is the center now? Who gets to define?
Well, the center's moved very far to the right in the past 40 years. There's no doubt about it. I mean, Richard Nixon looks like a flaming liberal, you know, today.
Wow. Ted in Burlington, Vermont. Ted, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Speaking to that woman's point earlier, I have a graph in a book that I'm working on right now that looks at average annual increase in pay for people across the, you know, the pay sector. And if you look at the lot lower quarter of the country, their annual increase is $93, while the Senate, the U.S. Senate, is $36,000 or $3,600 annual increase per year. It's a larger rate increase than the top 5%. So that's my first point. Second point is, I think that we would all be okay with austerity. I mean, I myself just finished my PhD. I can't find a job and, you know, really struggling. But I would be okay with austerity if I saw it was, you know, equally distributed across the country. And to hear people like, I don't know if you heard this, but there was a guy who runs Blackstone Group who said that Obama's anti-business rhetoric is like Hitler attacking Poland. I mean,
Steve Schwarzman,
The people at the bottom, the people that are suffering, if we were to go to D.C. right now and try and vent, we would be locked up. But yet the top 5%, they can go in the New York Times, they can go in the Wall Street Journal and have their op-eds and say whatever the hell they want.
Ted, keep on writing there, and I appreciate your call. We've got to get to George Bush. He's out on the hustings this week talking. Here he is in his primetime interview on Monday with NBC's Matt Lauer, explaining why he approved waterboarding.
We believe America is going to be attacked again. There's all kinds of intelligence coming in. And one of the high-valued al-Qaeda operatives was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, chief operating officer of al-Qaeda, ordered the attack on 9/11. And they say, he's got information. I said, find out what he knows. And so I said to our team, are the techniques legal? And a legal team says, yes, they are. And I said, use them.
Why is waterboarding legal, in your opinion?
Because the lawyer said it was legal.
Chrystia Freeland, how does George Bush come out looking with his new memoir out this week?
On waterboarding in particular, or
you name,
the
you name it
overall?
right across the board. Is this a rewriting of history? Is this telling it like it is?
Well, I would say the timing is absolutely brilliant. So it was very, very smart to be quiet for the first couple of years and come out right now after the midterms. And I think you could predict, right? Midterms are generally not great for the party in the White House. So even without a crystal ball, you could have predicted that there would be a bit of a Republican swing at this moment. So it's a great time for President Bush to be coming out and trying to tell his side of the story. I think that waterboarding explanation, at least for me, is incredibly weak. I think that surely countries want leaders who don't rely on legalisms when it comes to something so central to what it is to be a human being as torture. The other thing that I think is really interesting about Bush Week this week was actually the Bill O'Reilly interview, where he did press President Bush on the whole question of the deficit. And something that I think is worth remembering is that America's really difficult fiscal position right now was built up largely by a previous Republican administration.
We'll see where we go now. Veterans Week this week, and Jack, Veterans Week in a year, like so many years lately, when the country remains at war, and a leak this week saying that the pullout from Afghanistan may be put off, not next summer, but later, later, later. Colin Powell, Joe Biden, and a lot of people talking about how long so many troops are sacrificing in the field for this country in this Veterans Day week, Jack.
Oh, it's unimaginable when you just think of this thing going on to 2014 and beyond. To me, the comment of the week, and this connects to another leak, the leak of the study from the Pentagon, basically saying the military is okay with gay members. This is something from the Tribune's newspapers. It shows three caskets with the American flags on them, and underneath the caption, which one is gay?
Ouch. Ouch. And a lot of caskets, gay and otherwise. We remember all those veterans and we honor them in this week. And we hope, let's try, every week as these wars go on. Christopher Phelan with Thomson Reuters. It's always great to have you joining us today from New York. Thank you so much for being here, Christian.
Pleasure.
Todd Purdom, National Editor at Vanity Fair. You're great, Todd, and we appreciate you being here today. Thanks.
Pleased to be with you.
Jack Beattie, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.